Dr. Melhouse or your attorney, do you have any additional remarks or questions?
Yes, please.
Okay, come on forward.
Just going to respond to a couple of the things that have been said. Just briefly, sevoflurane was brought up. I think we covered that, but we do believe that it was within the standard of care and appropriate to up the sevoflurane dosage given the dog's exhibiting of pain, and it was appropriate to do so at the dosage that was done. And based on the literature that I referenced earlier, was not the cause of the dog going to cardiac arrest. It was also appropriate to perform the spay procedure at the time that it was done. The dog's upper respiratory symptoms had been resolved for several weeks, and nothing was contraindicated for the spay procedure. And while obviously this is a very unfortunate outcome, at the time there was nothing that would lead anyone to believe that this would be anything other than a normal routine spay. Responding to some of Mr. Wright's comments, we've already addressed the buprenorphine, and I won't rehash all of it since it was something that it seemed like the board had resolved at the last meeting. However, it just kind of to restate, we've already explained that there were some typos in regards to the perioperative versus the preoperative and the 0.3 versus the 0.6. We also did explain both at the board as well as in our written response that when consulting with the poison control hotline, it was determined that even had 0.6 been given for some reason, although we certainly contest that it was, that it wouldn't have resulted in any negative outcome like what happened here with this pet. I also addressed at the last meeting Dr. Melhouse's normal documentation processes, which I think is potentially what was just addressed, and what I attempted to explain was that Dr. Melhouse is very meticulous in her documentation practices. She has a basket of records that she takes home every day or reviews in the clinic to ensure that all of her documentation is correct. However, this case was difficult, and her emotions were spiked, and her adrenaline was spiked, as I'm sure anyone's would be in a situation like this. And so in situations like that where your emotions are spiked, it's not unusual to stray from your normal practice simply because your emotions are heightened, and that's what tends to happen. And so that is why the documentation typos were not caught the way that she would normally catch typos in her records. The last thing that I want to address is the comments about the opioids. We certainly believe that buprenorphine is a medication that is within the standard of care to use during spay procedures. And we also do not believe that a separate consent form for opioids is required when there is a consent for anesthesia. And certainly it would have been able to be discussed with the owner as necessary. So I think that's all the comments that we have, though certainly if the board does have any remaining questions, we are available, but otherwise we would again re-ask that the case be dismissed.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. It looks like Ms. Solomon has a question.
Yes, so Dr. Melhouse. How many spays have you performed, and at average, how long does it take you?
On average, it takes me an hour. I've been out of school now for 6 years. I perform at least once a month. It was higher frequency initially when I was a new grad. Plenty. I really can't give you a number.
Roughly once a month for 6 years?
At least.
And just to answer your question, Dr. Melhouse and I actually at the inception of this case went through and tallied up the number of spays she had done in a several month period. And it is in our first written response. I don't exactly know where, and I don't remember what it was, but it was several. And also just to add to the comment that she had said that she is slow at spays, my understanding from Dr. Melhouse is that her comment was that she goes slow at spays and to ensure that she's,
That I can sleep at night.
Yeah, and taking care of the pets appropriately and being careful.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do any other board members have questions? Dr. Wright on the phone?
No questions, just discussion.
Okay. Thank you. You may step back. This concludes the portion of the informal interview in which the board hears testimony. The board will now deliberate and decide what to do in this matter.
All right, so thank you. Can everybody hear me again?
Yes.
Okay, so like, this is a really kind of difficult case. Of course, anytime a patient passes away, we always want to try and figure out an answer. What exactly happened? What's going on? And sometimes we can see that. Sometimes we don't come up with anything. The necropsy is kind of the tell-all that we see when we see, okay, can we find a problem? But you don't always see problems with anesthetic deaths on necropsy. So it just kind of gets really difficult there. What we can talk about and what we can, I wanted to address right now because of the complainant's question on the buprenorphine. And I understand the kind of concentration issues and that kind of stuff. And I mean, from a layperson standpoint, seeing that, it's like, okay, this is really weird. Did we get an overdose or anything there? From a medical standpoint, buprenorphine is a very, very, very safe medication. And when we look at the LD50, I want to say for over 60 pounds, that's probably around 2 grams of buprenorphine that is going to be the LD50 when I looked all that stuff up. Because buprenorphine is a safe medication. It's one of those used in humans. I don't want to get into this, but of course, like in recovery from opioid epidemics or opioid addiction, because it is something that can kind of bring people down. It reverses itself. And so it's a very safe one that way. So I understand the concerns around the concentration and all that, but I don't see anything that's actually leading to death from that because of the medication. There can be some arguments, depending on who you talk to, using buprenorphine along with butorphanol. Does the buprenorphine reverse the TOR? What's going on? But that's kind of a divided thing. If you go to any kind of anesthetic continuing education and they talk about this, many, many anesthesiologists use them together. Some of them use them separate, some separate by a time, but they're very safe to get together. So I don't think, I know there's concern on the buprenorphine. I don't think there's any kind of overdose because that would just be a weird thing. Now, we bring up allergic reaction. Again, I don't see anything on the necropsy. If we had an allergic reaction, I would expect to see like a mast cell degranulation, histamines, inflammation around the body, and we didn't see that. So I know that there's some concern. I just wanted to address that with the owner in our discussion. But I don't think that the buprenorphine is actually a major issue that's going to really result in anesthetic death.
Dr. Wright, can I interrupt you for a minute? Can you explain LD50?
Oh, sorry, yes. So LD50 is a calculation that's done on toxicity of substances, and pretty much everything that's going to have any kind of studying on it, which is under OSHA, pretty much everything, they're going to kind of find out what concentration kills half of the animals that are exposed to it, that concentration. Once we get that concentration and half the animals pass away from that, that's what the toxic dose is. So really, that's kind of the calculation of, do we truly see a problem here or not? So below that, and significantly below that, tells me that it's probably nothing related to buprenorphine. Again, unless there was some kind of weird reaction, allergic reaction, which is not supported by the necropsy evidence.
Thank you.
Does that make sense to everybody, or anybody have questions around that?
No. I didn't. What I wanted to make sure you didn't have other questions.
Always want to have stuff in the record. Yeah. And then there was a question about perioperative medications, preoperative. And again, there's a lot of debate around that of when you can get things. The onset of action of buprenorphine, how long does that take to start working by IV route, by transmucosal? So there's a lot of questions and stuff around there. And again, that's I don't see any problems with perioperative use of medications. And I don't think that led to any kind of anesthetic death complications there. So does anybody else have anything on the buprenorphine and TOR that they'd like to address or questions around that before we move on to my other thoughts?
Do your other thoughts include explaining the elevated heart rate and respiratory rate?
Well, yeah, that's where we kind of go to next is talking about, like I said, the only other thing is the sebo fluorine concentration. And yeah, when you see the side effect of sevoflurane, usually it's depression of heart rate that starts to slow down until you eventually stop. And that's not what we saw. We saw a speed up of heart rate, which can be seen on that, especially because the doctor said that we saw some movement. So we were kind of keeping it a higher dose. And based on that movement, we gave the extra pain medication. So, I mean, that does make sense there. It's hard to explain why exactly that happened. But with sevoflurane overdose, even though we were 8% for a while, we tend to see, again, the drop in blood pressure, the drop in heart rate, the increase in the carbon dioxide dissolved in the blood, which we didn't have measured here, but again, that's not a requirement for anything. So we're seeing a fairly light animal because, like I said, we're seeing that increase in blood pressure, increase in heart rate. We gave the pain medication, and the heart just stopped. And that's the question, is why exactly that happened. And I mean, there's a lot of ifs, a lot of questions, a lot of possibilities, but I don't think there's a definitive cause. And like I said, even with the higher dose of sevoflurane, I don't see the typical signs you're going to see with an overdose of sevoflurane. Again, it's kind of the opposite of what we're seeing here. We would see an increase in these kinds of things, heart rate and whatnot, possibly with blood pressure loss or blood loss in surgery. But again, we're not seeing that on the necropsy. So nothing, unfortunately, is really fitting here. And I don't see a true explanation to say, is this actually a medical problem, or is this an unfortunate situation that just happened? And that's kind of where the discussion, I guess, kind of takes off from there.
So, Dr. Wright, where I was trying to lead you on that, and you did include some other stuff, but I was trying to lead you so a veterinarian was explaining it, not a layperson. Pain itself would increase the heart and respiratory rate, right?
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
So, Dr. Wright, this
And that was addressed possibly with the buprenorphine it was given. So I said that was a consideration that the doctor had during surgery to see that. But the sevoflurane does not appear to be, like I said, fully anesthetizing us, so we gave the additional pain medication, which, again, I think is an appropriate response. The response from the patient, and did that cause any issue there? Again, that's a possibility, but I think the reaction from the doctor is an appropriate response.
So, Dr. Wright, this is Robin, and I don't use SIBO, so I'm hoping that you can kind of give guidance on this.
But, well, I'll say I don't use it now, but I use it in the past in schools and at Zoom. So.
Okay. Well, I mean, if I related it all to the use of isoflurane, I've never run on a max amount for 20 plus minutes for any reason. Like, I've just never had a reason to do that, especially if you thought it was from pain and you'd given pain medication and you're still seeing a dog that's that reactive. It makes me say something wasn't right here. You shouldn't have had to run 20 plus minutes on 8%. So is that different with SIBO? Because I just, that doesn't seem right to me. And if, you know, yes, we were seeing the increased heart rate and respiratory rate, which isn't what you would expect, but if that was more from pain and maybe this dog had some other issues as far as, I don't even know, but like, it's not consistent with what I would say a low blood pressure to the point that they actually were questioning whether the cuff was working. And you're running a dog at 8% for 20 minutes, I would expect to see a low blood pressure.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a very good point. Like I said, the higher dose of sevoflurane, or even isoflurane, or desflurane, or whatever one we want to talk about, you don't usually run it at that rate. And why was it that high? Well, again, you bring up some good questions of, do we have, like I said, a possible overdose there? And that's, again, a question when we have something that long. But if we had an overdose, I wouldn't think we would be light enough to be feeling pain to be responding to the higher blood pressure and higher heart rate. Because we shouldn't be overdosing and completely aware of everything. It's kind of they're mutually exclusive things. So I understand what you're saying, and I agree with that. My other thought, and again, this is just one of those things you can't prove, and there's nothing on the necropsy report, is when we're intubating, was maybe only one lung being inflated. Again, we see atelectasis on the necropsy report, but that's going to happen all the time. But we don't see any kind of like hypoinflation or anything that could indicate that maybe only one side of the lungs are being inflated. Plus, we had a good pulse ox until that last one, which was at 96. We were at 99. We did have a drop. Wait, hold on, where were we at here? Yeah, oh, no, I'm sorry, we didn't have a drop. Yeah, so we had a 96 with the last one, which is, it's starting to go down, but that's still fine. And usually, that is not like in the range where you're going to be panicking at 96. So I understand that question there, but I would think if we were high on the sevoflurane and overdosing, we wouldn't be awakened to feel pain. But I don't know what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would agree. I just feel like there's some level of connection here between never having to run at max dose for 20 plus minutes, and I'm not sure why that wasn't questioned before we got to 20 plus minutes as to why is this dog not responding. And then you have this whole thing about
the loss of blood pressure and thinking it's a blood pressure cuff, I mean, why would we not have been thinking that that could have been related to this evoflurane? Mm-hmm. You know, I just feel like in that, that's the time period of this whole thing that to me makes me go, something happened here, and I don't know that we'll be able to figure out what. I wish I was smart enough to do that, but I don't know that we're going to be able to figure it out, but I just feel like something in that time period is where things started to go awry for this dog, and whether it was the fault of the veterinarian or not, I think it's going to be really hard to say. I think this doesn't present as a dog that just had a reaction to anesthesia and died. I feel like there was something here that happened, but...
Wouldn't you consider, I mean, at least from my perspective, max anesthetic percentage is a concern for that period of time, like you're saying. But the respiration rates, the pet was hyperventilating, and so aren't you concerned about their CO2 buildup? Because, I mean, and capnography is not documented here, but I'd be super concerned about that, especially if they're on a rebreather. Are they actually oxygenating accurately? SpO2 monitors are wildly inaccurate a lot of times anyways. So, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. To me, that the when the max SIBO goes up, there is a world of problems there.
Well, that's my thing. I mean, when you're getting to the point that you have to put it on 8 to begin with, you're going, something's not right. And we let it run at 8 for 20 minutes.
And it was really weird because it was 5-minute documentation intervals. And when it went to 8, it was a 10-minute gap, which I thought was odd. Even though our statutes say 15 minutes. But there was something happened in between there.
I mean, it just seems like to me, regardless of whether we could have changed the outcome or fixed anything, something should have happened when we got to having to run the SIBO that high for that long. Somebody should have been looking for a cause of why that was happening. And I don't see that being addressed, right? Like, I don't know that it would have changed the outcome, but I think that that should have triggered somebody to say, something's amiss right now. Something is not right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. And it's a good question. I want to address that the respiratory rate increasing. I agree. I think that is again telling us that we're not responding and we're still feeling some kind of pain. But with a sevoflurane overdose, you're usually going to see again the bradycardia, the bradypnea. That we're going to see the decrease in all that, and then we see a hypercardia as opposed to a hypo. And if we're panting, we'd be blowing off more carbon dioxide as opposed to less. So again, I agree. There's like weirdness going on, but it doesn't fit with a sevoflurane overdose from documentation that I've seen. So, I mean, there's thoughts there. Now, the other thought is, again, with pain medication, we use the butorphanol and the buprenorphine. I use butorphanol all the time for my procedures, spays, neuters, that kind of stuff. For more painful procedures, I'm going to use like hydromorphone. Was maybe the TORB not enough to cover that pain? Well, that's a possibility, and then we're seeing this response here. But again, that buprenorphine was given. Now, buprenorphine can take some time to start working. So possibly, again, there's just a delay in that, but that also shouldn't contribute to an anesthetic death. I mean, that would just be pain, which is not fun. We don't want to feel that. And we are under anesthesia, so hopefully we wouldn't be remembering something like that. But again, nothing fits. And I agree with Dr. Zoom. Like, there's questions, and it may be in relation to this, but it doesn't fit with saying yes for having an explanation. I think this is one of those, like on a human side, you're in the MMR round and you're just kind of discussing so that we can take the knowledge here and work forward. But I don't see a cause here. I see a lot of weird stuff, but no actual cause that would say this patient is actively dying and how can we reverse that and stop that.
And Dr. Wright, obviously in anesthetic deaths, like they are really hard because you often won't get an answer. But do you feel that with the changes that we were seeing as far as the SIBO and the blood pressure loss and things like that, that the steps that were taken were adequate? Because I think that's where I'd be going is, should we have done something different? And it's obviously when you're looking at it and you have hours to pour into these cases and read every which way possible, your decision's very different. So my decision is going to be different than if I were the one in surgery trying to do this and handle it in a 20-minute time period.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't do surgery anymore, so I can't even say if I would handle it this way. But it's just one of those things where I'm like, I feel like something different should have happened, even if it even if it didn't change the outcome, even if they just said, we are alerted to something's wrong and we need to address this cuff, or we need to re-intubate this dog, or we need to reverse this dog and do something different. Like, I just feel like something should have been done to try and combat this at the point that we were running that high. And I'm struggling a little bit with that, but maybe that's not what you would say would be expected in that situation.
No, and I think that brings up a good point. I can see things that I might have done different, but in that moment, I mean, you never think about the different options. Like, you go through your protocols and you do what you think it is. It's going to be the best thing. I mean, I might have adjusted the tube or something, and like that. I might have actually, if I had one of my best technicians who can intubate with a dog under upside down, I might have had her pull the tube and re-intubate while we're on the table, give some more propofol or something. So, I mean, we can definitely go through and kind of say, yeah, I would have done this different. But in that moment, I guess the question is, was something done wrong? And I mean, yeah, we recognized the issues. It's not like we ignored it, because we did address it with the buprenorphine. So we recognized that we were moving a little bit and we had some pain, so we gave pain medication. And 99 times out of 100, that's going to fix everything and we're good to go. And so was that the cause of something? Well, again, maybe, but again, the necropsy didn't show it. I would think if we had a reaction, an allergic reaction, we would have like a histamine response all over the body. We would see that, and you can definitely see that on necropsy. It's just beyond, yes, there's things that could have been different, like we can in every case that we start to revisit. I don't see this was the problem. I mean, or specifically, quote unquote, whatever it is, saying, yeah, this caused that death. This is an anesthetic death. Unfortunately, if you're doing surgery, you're going to have anesthetic deaths from time to time. And like I said, yeah, we could have addressed this differently in hindsight, but was this addressed improperly during it? I can't say that.
Yeah, and I think that's where my mind was going, is I don't think we're going to figure out the cause, and I don't think necessarily that we can even place a reason for the anesthetic death. I think that the question is did we do what we should have with what we had?
Yeah.
And, you know, I definitely think that it's different when you're looking at it on paper months later and not in the emotion and not in the midst of surgery and not doing all these things, but...
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of where my brain has gone a little bit as to this case.
No, I think I think my brain's in the same place, but I'm kind of more in the MMR type thing of what can we learn and move forward, because I can't say something truly happened. I can't say the doctor truly caused this. Like I said, because if there's some other kind of supporting evidence, but like I said, yeah, we had high cecal fluorine, but that doesn't fit with the signs of cecal fluorine overdose. We have high cecal fluorine, but we're still moving around, which doesn't fit with overdose. I think everything was looked at and addressed. Could it have been addressed differently? Yes, but was the way it addressed problematic? And I can't say that. So,
Madam Chair, I have a question of Dr. Wright and Dr. James. Were the red flags, the elevated heart rate and the elevated respiration rate, were they long enough in duration for some corrective action? If those were perceived or should have been perceived as red flags, was that a long enough duration? It wasn't a single spike, it went on for a period of time. Was that sufficient time to have taken some other action?
Again, post looking at it, possibly, but you see the heart rate going up. And again, we saw that and responded with the pain medications there, but you don't really see that respiration spiking until, like I said, the very end there. And I mean, that's when we really kind of started dealing with the CPR and the actual heart stopping. Like I said, the blood pressure going up, all that. Again, if we're moving around, if we're feeling pain for whatever reason that is, then I would expect to see those things. So yeah, it'd be a concern, but it would be a concern saying this patient is dying? No, because we definitely see, I mean, especially if I'm doing like a knee surgery or something, I cut through the joint capsule and the dog's like, oh my God, and they don't necessarily move, but you see that spike in the heart rate. You see the respiration going up, and that's just because of the way the physiologic response in the body goes. We can definitely see when we're doing a spay, you tug on that suspensory ligament and you tear it down, you're going to see a spike in the heart rate and the respiration at that point, and that's just a physiologic response. Doesn't mean the animal's awake. They're just responding that way. So, yeah, I mean, when you start seeing a respiratory rate of like 75, that's a big problem. 56, that's high. And like, so we gave that pain medication, the 14, 21, that's fine there. Again, we have the oxygenation, we have the blood pressure. So it's a good question, but again, we saw in the moment from the doctor's explanation that we were moving and she was assuming pain, which makes sense. So she responded, and did she respond appropriately? Well, yeah, I mean, she gave an additional pain medication at a, yeah, weird concentration looking thing, but the actual dose did not have caused any problems with that.
So just in kind of what was said during the initial thing on sevoflurane and looking into the reactions to it, I mean, obviously, if the most common side effect is hypotension, and we have a dog that was hypotensive to the point that we blamed it on the cuff,
mm-hmm.
and increased respiratory rate and some of the other excitable changes and things like that come later, did we just not get there? You know what I mean? Like, did we?
Yeah.
This dog became so hypotensive and we weren't reacting to it that ultimately it didn't sustain life, but we didn't even get to the point that we would have had an increased respiratory rate or excitation. I don't know. I don't think we're going to be able to answer this question. I'm probably being way too academic about this, but I just...
that's what we do on the board.
I feel for the donor because I want an answer, and
yeah.
I'm not getting there. And I just feel like... And I'm sure the veterinarian wants an answer. I'm sure everybody wants an answer,
yeah.
So I keep overthinking it, but...
I agree. And that's why I think the discussion is important, because I want the owner to know, like, especially around the buprenorphine, because that was a big concern. And I understand that concern, and I want to acknowledge that for sure. But, yeah, did that lead to anything? Not at that dose, like, it doesn't explain. Yeah, I agree. Like, I wish I could give a solid answer, and there's a lot of questions, but, I mean, I don't think that's solid enough to move forward either way on that. I mean, even beyond the letter of concern, but, I mean, that, even then, it's like, can you say that? Well, maybe, but I'm not seeing an actual violation. I'm seeing things that could have been done different, but if we saw these things and instead of reaching for buprenorphine, we reached for some other, I don't know, like azepromazine or something, okay, that's a problem. But I see an appropriate response, it just was an unfortunate result.
So I'm going to ask, you're talking about hypotension. When I'm looking at the blood pressure here, it looks like it's going up. Am I reading this wrong? 172 is higher than 103.
Yeah,
that's I thought hypertension. That's what I was like. I was going to ask about hypotension. I don't know if I missed something somewhere else, but I'm seeing, like I said, that 172 over 91 with a MAP of 97, MAP of 96, 100, 98. So I'm like, yeah, that's a high blood pressure.
I'm
so I mean, it's going to drop it again.
Question from Dr. Nosley, which was the loss in blood pressure. Why was it considered a failure of the cuff?
So, yeah, and like I said, so the only blood pressure I didn't see recorded was at the 855, and was that maybe what was going down there? Like on the anesthetic monitoring sheet, like I've seen hypertension.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we're going to answer this, and I agree with you.
No.
I think, you know, it's good to chat through it and put the time and energy into it because we can learn from it, but I don't know that we're going to be able to answer what happened.
No.
One thing that I would like to put out there that we haven't discussed yet, what we have discussed that necropsy did not provide any answers. But what we haven't said to put in the record is, if you don't do a necropsy, you're guaranteed you will have no answers, right? You're never guaranteed you're going to get exactly the answers that you're seeking with a necropsy, but you're guaranteed you're going to get nothing without doing it. Unfortunately,
no,
in this case, unfortunately, in this case, where we'd really like a clue, and it didn't give us one.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the necropsy was certainly the right way to go to try and get closure on this and to learn from it. But, and I don't have any issues with the age or any of that. That the spay was done. None of that seems out of line. So
yeah,
I was. We always did everything 6 months. Cats. Dogs.
What's that?
6 months.
Is what you like?
In the shelter, we do them at 12 weeks.
Yes.
Eight weeks before.
But that's because you don't know what the hell's going to happen to them, right?
No, but we don't have complications either. We don't have a higher complication rate doing them that early, which is why I'm saying that the timing of this was not the issue. I think why people argue over the timing of the spay is related to other things, not anesthetic complications.
I agree.
Yeah.
I don't really have anything else.
Okay. Yeah, I think this is, unfortunately, like I said, Dr. Jane's been saying, we wish we could have an answer. I think this comes down to we don't have an answer. We don't. There's no blame to place. This is an unfortunate situation. Indy's, like I said, no longer with us. I think we all have these cases. Dr. James, I know you have these cases. Well, I shouldn't say I know, but I suspect you have these cases, and every doctor does, that stick with us for the rest of our career. We don't have an answer as to why. We don't know what happened, but I think this is going to be one of those that Dr. Melhouse just remembers forever, and we kind of use every case that we have to try and do better the next time. And I think that's where this is. It's very unfortunate. It's very sad that we lost Indy, and I wish we had an answer. I wish we had something, but this is something that Dr. Melhouse will always remember, because I have those cases too where I don't have an answer, and I try and basically vow to do my best later, never have to lose another patient.
So I think
she did everything that she could. It's just, it's an unfortunate situation, and yeah, we're all going to learn from every unfortunate situation you ever have come into in medicine.
So, Dr. Wright, in my initial notes, I had a letter of concern marked down with a question mark. Because the responsible veterinarian, which happens to be Dr. Melhouse in this situation, kind of let the corporate entity take over issue management. And that may be their policy, but guess what? They're not here.
Yeah.
She is. It's her license, her premise license, and I mean, I think the letter of concern would say, you got to stand up for yourself and say, no, my license at stake, I'm going to handle these communications with my client, not somebody in a corporate office that doesn't know who these people are.
I understand that, but I mean, the only way I could think of a letter of concern would be like, is that like a not treating the owner with respect under the ethics violation? And that's just kind of a hard bar for me there too.
I mean, again, letter of concern,
non-disciplinary, it's a reminder. I understand what you're coming from there. I think it's kind of the conversation I've had ever since day one, about 9.5 years ago when I was started at the board. Long time, geez. The corporations do not look out for your license. They don't care. They're looking for a dollar. Yeah. And honestly, you need to be the one that says, I'm not doing this. I'm not comfortable with this. I'm going to do it this way. Because without the veterinarian, they can't exist. So we need to have a veterinarian saying, I'm protecting myself. I'm doing what I think is right. And you're going to have to go along with me. Except because the corporations, we can't hold anybody responsible but that veterinarian in front of us.
But
is that a letter of concern for reminding that? I think what a conversation would get that point across.
And I would go along with what Dr. Wright just shared. A letter of concern is to notify a pursuant to the definition, notify the veterinarian that they should modify or eliminate certain practices, and the continuation of the activities could result in discipline against the veterinarian's license. This is more, the interaction between a vet and corporate and how complaints are handled with corporate. So I'm not sure. I think, again...
I think one of the triggers for this was somebody sent the uncensored necropsy report to the owners.
Right.
Which... is a matter of opinion, right?
Right.
I mean, if you sent me an necropsy report without any pictures, I would ask you, what are you doing? Why don't you have the pictures with it? But they didn't want to see those.
You're not a typical owner, though.
Well, yeah, it was like, I don't
to me, it's like your high school biology class, right? I mean, you're going
to
cut the frog open, so what?
But it's
different. But she knew the guy and would have known this, and knew both of them, and would have known, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take these out. You wouldn't have handed them to somebody else to take care of it, because you know that no, I need to edit this before I send it. So that kind of got. I mean, I think it might not violation, but I think it might have been a trigger that escalated what could have been a conversation that worked itself out without coming here. Maybe. Hindsight's 20/20. Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
No, and I agree. Like I said, necropsies, we think about, because we've all been to funerals, or most of us at least, and we see the people, and they're in the coffin, and they've had an autopsy, typically, or something going on. It's different in animals. I mean, I've done necropsies throughout school many, many times. I've done them at my hospital. I've done them, like, at the zoo. You always do that, and it is not something that an owner wants to see, to the point where, personally, unless I really saw a problem, I would not get a necropsy on my personal animals. I didn't find my last one that passed away, even though I questioned as to what was truly happening, because I kind of know what happened. And yes, it's a medical procedure, but it's a hard thing to see, for sure, on your own personal child. It's rough, but again, that's just one of those, that was a bad mistake, but I mean, it's part of the medical record, and statute requirements are to release the medical record. So again, is that even a violation of anything? No, it's unpleasant, but I mean, it's legal stuff is sometimes unpleasant, or most of the time.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Ms. Solomon wants.
So yeah, I would just make a. So it's unfortunate. I think we've had a lot of conversation, but I would make a motion based on the conversation, based on everything here, to dismiss with no violation.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second to dismiss case 2392 with no violation. Is there any further discussion?
Yes, ma'am. Section of the rules, R311501, number 5. And is Dr. Melhouse the responsible veterinarian? Is my first question. Yes.
I think so. I think that's what Dr. Logan said.
Okay. That section reads, a responsible veterinarian employed by a partnership, corporation, or individual that is not licensed by the board shall ensure that the veterinary judgment and responsibility of each veterinarian employed by the partnership, corporation, or individual is neither influenced nor controlled by the partnership, corporation, or individual to detriment of an animal. I think that kind of goes to the question that Mr. Logie raised.
I don't know what it was to the detriment of the animal, though. It was to the detriment of the emotions of the owner.
Yeah.
I don't know whether.
Yeah, I think that's a good question that you have there. Mr. Logie.
Yes. No, go.
Oh, yeah, no, I think you raised a good question. I kind of, again, this is me personally, I look at that more as if a corporation or some overarching business was having you order extra hydromorphone and they were distributing it out to the public or ketamine or something like that. I kind of look at this more of like actually egregious things. I don't see that as, okay, the corporation says that they're going to be the ones that talk to us and then we go from there. Because that doesn't change the medical portion of it. That changes what we see, and like the, it's just going to be elevated to the board, but it doesn't change what truly happened during the situation. It just gives us less of an ability to defuse the situation before a complaint is lodged. So yeah, I think it's a good question, but I see that as more of that kind of, like, that you're doing something fraudulent because this company is just telling you to and you're not standing up for yourself. And I don't see that as applying here.
Okay, so if there's no further discussion now, we have a motion on the table and a second to dismiss this case. There's no further discussion. Let's do roll call. Or just voice vote.
You can do a voice vote.
Sorry. So voice vote on this. So all those in favor of dismissing case 2392, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Thank you. This concludes this matter. And Dr. Melhouse, you will receive written confirmation of the board's action shortly. If you have any questions in the meantime, please contact the board's executive director, Victoria Whitmore. And this concludes the informal interview. Thank you all for being here today.